time for one more before dinner.
Mine's probably pretty short.
Okay.
All right, it's on conversation analysis. From what I read, which was from primarily an article written by Sachs, I believe.
Yeah.
And can't pronounce his name. Shegloff? Shegloff?
No. Oh, okay. I've heard the name.
Yeah, I think it was actually something that you told us that would be a good resource for that. So I based a lot of what I wrote in my paper on that. So conversation analysis, from what I gathered, is a mode of inquiry associated but not interchangeable with modes of inquiry associated with applied linguistics. To me, it sounded like applied linguistics, people in that field would look more at the entire sentence. Mm-hmm. In conversations, and they would try to, I guess, interpret or analyze the entire sentence, whereas conversation analysis actually, they use tools to analyze conversations and to put them into frameworks and to go past just what the words mean and to try to get at how conversations flow, what that says about what the person meant to say. That makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's based on two premises, according to one of the papers I read. So it's meant to uncover as much an extent as possible the speaker's intent, and intents can vary. There are just a lot of different intents. I think what you were talking about when you brought up the Princess Diana's conversation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
would that be conversation analysis?
It could be.
Yeah, looking
you
at
could use it.
Yeah, I thought maybe that would be. So looking at what the speaker means to say. Are they trying to confirm something about themselves or confirm a fact, or are they using language to complain about something, to invite, to ask, to establish positionality in a relationship, things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily, this analysis is not necessarily accessible to the person doing the analysis right away. So you don't just look at the words and know what the person means. You have to actually use the tools associated with CA to figure out what's going on there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Does it make questions? Okay. I hate speaking in front of people, so I'm sure with my tongue.
You're very good.
Anyway. the second premise on which CA is based, the different tools that CA uses. So they break conversations often into a series of turn-taking. So they look at conversations in terms of the turns that people take. So you've got speaker A, and speaker A will talk for a little bit, and then they'll leave a space. They'll pause for a second, and apparently a 1 second pause between speaker A and speaker B would mean somebody start talking now. I'm done. Either someone else should start speaking, or I'm going to keep going. So they leave that pause there, and speaker B will either realize that this is being done, or will intentionally not engage in the conversation, or will engage at the appropriate time. You know. In one of the articles I read, it broke down a phone conversation. Someone will phone up and you'll say hello, and the other person will say, hi, is so-and-so there? And that's we anticipate that, and if you break that rule,
mm-hmm,
it says something about what speaker A or speaker B is trying to accomplish. So if you've got someone that phones you and says nothing, you've just got silence.
heavy breathing.
You know, you can interpret that in a number of different ways, whereas normally we would just go through the usual steps. And I think in one of our courses that we took, we had a girl who deliberately, she had a telemarketer phoner?
Yeah,
Lori. Lori had a telemarketer, a gal from our last course, and she had a telemarketer phoner, and she deliberately messed up what would normally be expected.
Yeah.
And I think she thoroughly confused the person on the other end of the phone.
Oh.
I can't remember what she did.
Yeah,
she paused for abnormally long periods and didn't
mm-hmm
respond,
mm-hmm,
and the person on the other line didn't know what to do. You know?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing.
Isn't that called breaching or something like that?
Yeah. So I guess turns, that's one framework you could use. Another one is, let's see here, a speaker repair. So you can learn a lot from looking at, okay, so let's say speaker A doesn't understand what speaker B said, literally didn't understand. They will elicit a recast of some kind. They'll say either, could you please repeat that? And it could literally mean, I didn't understand, could you please repeat that? They could be, they're being patronizing.
Mm-hmm.
It could be about an auditory problem. There could be a number of different ways of interpreting that kind of thing. And that made me think about my context as a French immersion teacher. It often happens in my classroom where I'm faced with a choice. And I've got a child in my classroom who's speaking incorrectly, mm-hmm. grammatically incorrectly. But I'm teaching about math or social studies or science. And I don't know if anybody, are you teachers here? Are you familiar with having taught? Mm-hmm. You want to keep the pace going, especially with kids like that. You don't want, because you'll lose them. So if I have to make a split second decision. Am I going to correct this child's grammar, or am I going to keep going with my lesson? So by doing that, I'm deliberately reinforcing the error, because if I keep not correcting the error, they come to think, oh, she thinks that's okay. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's I'm sure you could sit in my classroom and interpret all sorts of things based on when I choose to ask for clarification. So language feedback is a tool used, or you can study the feedback given between speakers to interpret meaning. I think that's basically what I thought that it meant.
Okay.
Yeah.
It has a.
Yeah.
It's the one that comes with the most particular kind of transcription.
It seemed very, very regimented.
And I don't have an example, but uh-huh. I do have an example to show you from the kind of things you were just speaking about.
So particular transcription rules or.
A method of transcription that's quite detailed. I just think this book has some here, I think.
This is like transcription symbols.
I didn't come across.
All kinds of the colons to show degrees of elongation of the prior sound. The more colons, the more elongation. HHH aspiration outbreath,
mm-hmm.
inspiration dot HHH inbreath, you know, all that kind of, mm-hmm. hyphens mark a cutoff of the preceding sound, greater than less than mm-hmm. signs in close speeded up talk,
mm-hmm.
you know, all that just gives you, you know, a tiny glimpse of how detailed this can be, and that's just, you know, one kind of thing. But let's look at this abstract here for a second as an example of some of the things.
That's used a lot in chat. Online, yeah, I have friends who use a lot of very, very interesting language in chat that looks a lot like that with the brackets and different things. I wonder if that's where it comes
mm-hmm.
from, some of it.
Like more
and all the extra, because mm-hmm. when someone's shouting at you, they'll put mm-hmm. brackets around the whole way around it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot in this area to do with different frameworks, I keep calling them frameworks, in different settings. So different settings would imply different types of conversations. But you can have a family-type conversation within an institutional setting within your workplace. In an educational institution, teachers might sit around and talk about teacher stuff, and there'd be certain things that we would be expected to say at certain times, but we could break out into spontaneous conversation about our children or something completely different, which would bring on a whole different set of rules.
Yeah.
So.
And Deborah Tannen's done lovely work in this area on male-female,
mm-hmm.
and boy-girl even, she's done it both in terms of the kind of conversation, but also video, looking at the positions of how, you know, she was the one who brought out into big attention how, you know, women will lean in when they talk and men,
mm-hmm.
men, you know, turn away from each other, lean different ways. And she did a lot of that work. So if you look here, just an example. So here's an interview by a young male student with a woman friend on the topic of formative influences on occupational choice. Okay. So the interviewer, the young male student interviewer, says, "Relax, this is nothing that will be judged." Respondent, "I'm not looking at the questions." Interviewer, "All I want is to find out a few things concerning your family, educational, friends, aspirations, motivations, etc." "Okay, and I'll give you feedback on it later on." And the respondent, "Not now." Interviewer, "No, you can have anything you have said which you do not want to be discussed erased." Interviewer, "Aha." Our respondent, sorry. Interviewer, "You can also have anonymity. You can choose your pseudonym if you want to." responded, oh, fine. Interviewer, as long as it isn't, it says the name, his name. Respondent laughed. Interviewer, oh, yes, I'll be taking a few notes, which have nothing to do with your answers during the interview. Is this okay? Respondent, you'll be taking notes? I see, okay. Interviewer, no. Respondent, so you're going to be watching me as well? Interviewer, I'll record anything that's interesting, relevant. Respondent, I'll put my hands behind my back then. But that's life. As long as I learn from my mistakes. What was the question again? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Interviewer, it's okay, you've answered it. Respondent, good. Stop looking at my legs. Interviewer, erased. Respondent, sorry, I just wanted to say that. Sorry. Interviewer, let's continue, okay? And cover your legs. So very realistic, you know, interview, encounter. If you've ever done one, you know, it's like, ooh. And, you know, it could be a nightmare if you're really interested in, what was it, occupational? Formative influences on occupational choice. What a nightmare that could be. But if you were not so interested in that, you were more doing conversation analysis about the interaction, then you might have come up with some of these sorts of themes. So this is what one analysis had been done. One and that theme one would be using the position of the respondent. So the respondent asserts her power as respondent in a context in which the interviewer is dependent on her for the completion of his work. Right? So she knows that. You know, you're interviewing me for this, you need my interview, so to speak. So she's got that power position. Also, the embarrassment caused by her comments invokes the framework of potential sexual exploitation. Again, redressing that balance, right, of power. Another theme that a conversation analysis might take out of that, or similarly discursive analysis could do the same kind of thing, but not phenomenological anymore, though. You can see the difference, right, already, how we're looking at the interaction, not the subjective experience, okay? Theme two, respondent-initiated reflexive commentary. And what that would be was where the respondent exploits that upper-handedness of the interviewer reminding her of the research contract, which he appears to inform her of, rather than negotiate it with her. Okay, so he's about to tell her that very set thing about you can go blah, 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 and she's messing that out, much like you said. She's not just going along with what he would have expected, which would be yes, of course, yes, fine. She's throwing in things. Theme three would be the public nature of the account. And this means respondent uses the public nature of the account, meaning it's being taped, and we know it's not just a private thing between them, to resist the interview-respondent relationship. The interviewer's reaction to stop looking at my legs is in terms of his awareness of the tape recorder, immediately said erased, right? Which the respondent then reasserts the public nature of the account, saying, sorry, I just wanted to say that, sorry. Like, you know, knowing that that's going on. So the whole idea of that context is set up from that. And the last one you might consider is past-future relations. And that comes from the teasing tone of the respondent. It indicates that she is using the prior relationship between them as a way of establishing power in this situation, perhaps in order to ease her own anxiety in what is obviously not a usual situation for them to be in. Right? Good. So it's nice, isn't it? You can see how that works. And if that was the kind of interest you had, and you had research questions that wanted that sort of analysis, well, here's the kind of thing you can do. All I would say is that my take on this, personal take again, is that I believe you can do this kind of work without having to do the transcription to the extent that it is done, okay? Because if you're interested in an educational issue, you're not interested in doing a linguistic analysis. Why would you need to necessarily go to that level? That's my opinion about it. I've seen you're not applied linguists, so therefore it seems silly to go to that level if you can, you know, address. We didn't have that level there, and yet I was able to show you some themes that you could see where they would come from. I could root them in the data. Very good, very nice. Okay, dinner time.
Short is good.
Short and sweet.
Okay.
Don't worry. Is anybody staying here, Ben?